With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to IFHPodcastNetwork.com.
Welcome to Filmmaking Conversations with Damian Swaby. Listen to conversations with award-winning filmmakers, directors from the golden age of television, and creatives from the indie film community who continue to inspire the next generation of filmmakers. And now, over to your host, Damian Swaby.
Today on Filmmaking Conversations, I speak to a teller of stories, mostly fiction, but always real. With a deft ability to balance both half-hour single-camera comedies and one-hour dramas, Pete Chapman has directed episodes of The Flight Attendant, Insecure, Silicon Valley, Blackish, A Million Little Things, Station 19, Mixed-ish, Single Parents, and so much more. He is in development on the education of Matt Barnes with Showtime, for which he will direct the pilot and serve as executive producer, and is currently co-executive producer and producing director on Reasonable Doubt, the first project to be produced via Hulu's Onyx Collective. Through the director, his digital studio, he has directed, shot, and edited content for advertising agencies and Fortune 500 brands. Chapman's career began in 2001 with the Sundance selection of his NYU thesis film 3D, starring Kerry Washington. His most recent short film, Black Card, premiered on HBO. His podcast, Let's Shoot with Pete Chapman, is available on YouTube, iTunes, and all podcast platforms. In January 2022, his book, Transitions, A Director's Journey and Motivational Handbook, will be released by Michael Wise Productions. This book is one of the best filmmaking books I've ever read, and I'll put a link to the book within the show notes. We'll be discussing his career, his book, and so much more. And now, for my filmmaking conversation with Pete Chapman. Pete, how are you today?
Damian, I'm great, brother. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, anytime. Thanks so much for coming on and allowing me to read your brilliant book. And thank you for all the work that you've done over the years. It's really... really good to see some of the stuff you've done and to read about your history in terms of going to NYU and how you've got to where you are today. So you've done so much great quality work and you've written this book. Now, a lot of people have come on the podcast and spoke about the book that they've written, but why exactly did you write this book?
Well, it's funny, man. It's like, I think... part of me even wanting to be a filmmaker or a storyteller was always this like procedural thing that I would do, which is I kind of watch events happen, even if they happen to myself, and then hop up to 10,000 feet and look at it and wonder, you know, well, why is it like this? Or how could it be better? Or what could have been avoided, right? And I spent my time in film school and then, you know, almost 18 years after graduating and trying to get into TV, like just constantly making note of like, someone could have told me that, you know what I mean? Like I could have been pointed in a direction. there are just these gaps in information that I don't think need to be there. And I also feel like for filmmakers and storytellers of color, or women, or veterans, or disabled folks, you know, like there are, the journey's a little tougher, right? And not having a blueprint that's honest, and I don't even want to say blueprint, not having an idea of the principles and the path that you'll take to get to where you want to go that's honest, leaves some people disenchanted. And I think many people quit, many super talented people quit before their time comes because they're not fully aware of what the road ahead looks like. And so I felt I'd be remiss to not share what I was seeing, because I've always been looking at everything, every step of the way, wondering how could this be better? And, you know, even when I taught at NYU, I did, you know, I had a syllabus, right? And I had what I was required to teach, but there would be like a couple things I'd do each semester. Like even for my seniors before they graduated, I had a whole 8-hour day dedicated to like, here's the real shit for when you get out of school. Like, we're going to set aside time and really talk about it, because, you know, the idea that this diploma has prepared you to be a professional, you know, I don't know if that's true. So long-winded answer perhaps, but that the book was really what did I want to read? You know, what did I wish I would have had on my journey in my back pocket, or, you know, on my bookshelf, or in my ears as a podcast, that could have made some of the, you know, some of the brawls a little less bloody.
So how do your employers at NYU feel when you, in a sense, deviate from the script and tell the students there's what I'm teaching you and there's what you need to know?
Well, you know what? It's interesting. I always completed what was assigned to be taught. Right. It's almost like coverage when you're shooting something, right? It's like, okay, I'm going to shoot this scene and I'm going to get what the show requires. And then I have this instinctual idea for something that, you know, if you guys like it, it's here for you. It's going to be in my director's cut, you know, but like, you don't have to necessarily, you know, air it. And so, you know, what was often really rewarding would be like, it would take sometimes, you know, 4 or 5 years later, some of those students would be like, now I know what you were saying 4 years ago when you talked about it's not necessarily going to be about your talent, or you know, being good in the room is going to be more important than being great on a set for some of you. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, I always tried to satisfy the requirements of what any job was asking of me. But then I would always be looking for how I can amplify and enhance and give more. Because at the end of the day, it's about value, right? Like, it's not about like some bullet point checklist of items to say we did it. Like if we, you know, even earlier on in my working career at NYU before I was teaching, it was like there was a big philosophical debate about whether or not we should remain on film or transition to video or do both. And it's like, if we're teaching kids nothing but film, when out in the world, we're more and more using video as the means of capture, what's the point? You know what I mean? Like, there's no value in teaching someone something that's not actually going to be applicable.
Oh, completely. And I loved in your book, you mentioned using Kodak film stock at one point on a C16 camera, I think you mentioned, and you
CP16.
Yes, I admittedly I had to look that one up when I read about it. That's one of the cameras I hadn't heard of, and I could see a great look coming from it on some of the footage that I saw online. Really, really liked it. But you also use the Canon 7D. I think I'm right by saying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The 7D. Yeah, we used that when once the those DSLR cameras became, you know, the way to go, and that's even an interesting journey because they were never meant for film production. They were just meant for these news photographers to have an ability to capture snippets of video. And then we heard about it, we being thousands and thousands of filmmakers, and we're like, wait, it shoots HD? And you can just hold it like this and put all your interchangeable photo lenses on it? We're like, we're going to take that.
Oh, yeah. And it is such a beautiful thing to be able to just take these things, and you can get them anywhere now, mirrorless cameras as well. So it's a great era to be in. And I can see entirely why you have made that debate, that argument, sorry, to suggest that the way forward isn't necessarily film. If people are going to be leaving to work in a digital environment that we're in right now, and collaborators right. that you met at film school, the role of a producer by your side, can you tell us about that mm-hmm. and how important that was for you to progress?
Oh man, it was, you know, it was everything. I often joke, it's not funny, but I say, you know, I always wanted to direct first. I started writing so I'd have something to direct. I started producing so I could manage the logistics to direct the thing that I wrote. And then I would act in those projects because I knew as a good producer, it'd be one less person to feed, you know? And so you're doing all of these different parts of the process as you start out. And there's a point where you begin to recognize that you are better off with a supportive team. But the challenge is finding people that you can trust and you can comfortably relinquish some of your, you know, overbearing hand on the project. Because in the beginning, you just like, you know, it no one cares as much as you, no one's getting paid, and it's not going to happen without your like tunnel vision. And so when you find the people who are as interested in producing as you are in directing or writing, it's a beautiful collaboration. And so for me, Christina DeHaven was that person. We met in writing workshop in our freshman year at NYU. She produced, we were in our sophomore year, we were in the same crew for this class called Sight and Sound Film, where we worked on 16 millimeter Arriflex cameras with like the three lens turret that gave you like a normal, a wide, and a long lens. And we worked in crews of four. And what we did was we'd rotate. So if I was directing, someone was my DP, someone else was, you know, helping to carry gear, PA, whatever. We were all like rotating through a system. But every year of school after freshman year, she was my producer. So my short film in my junior year that we shot on the CP16, she produced that. My thesis film, 3D, that starred Kerry Washington and Dorian Missick and went to Sundance, she produced that. She hired me in my administrative job at NYU, which gave me income. Yeah. And then, you know, she produced a documentary that I did in 06, a feature documentary. And she just produced most recently, God, two more things. She did a short film I produced that HBO picked up, called Black Card, in 2014. And then I did this narrative audio podcast Wednesday morning in 2020 that she produced. And so that's a 20, now that I'm talking about it, man, that's a 21-year relationship, you know? I just recognized early on that she was so committed to producing, and it's a creative job in and of itself, even though sometimes people kind of don't talk about it in that way. But she was always a creative partner in problem solving to make sure that the vision could be accomplished.
I'm glad you've got that relationship with someone, because I agree, without it, and especially in the early days of things and starting out, you're giving up such important roles and such important positions. And you may be thinking, can they do it? Can I trust this person? Without the trust, sometimes how do things progress? And one of your right. projects went to Sundance, which was brilliant. I actually, even though we've never met, in my mind, I had a vision of you receiving the voicemail when you found out your project signed
to Sundance. And I was like, yeah, I'm really happy for him because that must have been just amazing in that situation. But there was a situation that happened after Sundance, and you had some sort of disagreement, or you had, you in your own words, self-importance was the situation that occurred. What was that situation actually about? And after all these years, how would you have handled it differently?
So what you're talking about is, you know, in short, there's, you graduate film school and there is a festival, or was it, I think it's still there. There is a festival where basically all work completed in a production class will be shown. So the barrier to entry is completion, right? And so after, you know, it took a little while to get the funds together to finish my film. And so while I typically would have had it done like the year prior, but because it took so long, I was in the school's festival 2 years after graduating. And so in the interim, that short film had gotten into Sundance, and I was like, oh wow, this is like amazing. This is what has been expressed to us as the pinnacle of student filmmaking. And so in my mind, I'm like, I did it, I achieved it. So then I felt presumptuously that when we would return with the film to the film festival at the school, that it would be lauded, it would be awarded, it would be given its praise or whatever. And I'd even be maybe catapulted to higher levels of success, right? And I was even, in my naive mind, driven to believe that even further, because all the promotion around the film festival that year was including my film, which was one of five or six from both the grad and undergrad department to have gone to Sundance that year. So I'm thinking, like, I'm in there, it's all gravy, like, this is gonna be a sweep of awards or whatever, I'll get something. And then when we when the awards came down, there's craft awards, you know, for cinematography, writing, direction, ensemble cast, whatever. And then there's first, second, and third prize for, you know, best short or whatever. And the film didn't get recognized for any of the things, while being consistently used to promote the entire festival. And so I was just like, okay, that doesn't square with me. And you know, I get it now, but at the time I was like, fuck that, right? And so I had a meeting with the then chair of the department, who had also been my instructor in my sophomore year production class and one of my favorite teachers. And I was like, look, how are you guys doing this? Like, this is BS. Like, I don't understand how you're using it to promote. I've done what you told me since before freshman year, and orientation was the pinnacle of achievement for a student filmmaker. And as far as I'm concerned, it seems like it didn't even happen. And so, you know, he explained to me, he was like, look, we've had films that have won at Sundance that did not get awards when they came back to the school. And, you know, it was humbling. But I was like, again, to your first question, I was like, well, what's going on here? Why would this have happened? And so I try to be as honest with myself as possible. And I was like, well, I didn't really build any allies while I was here. You know what I mean? Like, I was there, I was doing the work, you know, but many, many times I was just going right back to Jersey on the weekends, you know, to New Jersey from New York, to be with my girlfriend at the time, or, you know, be with my family, or go hang with my friends from back there. And it's like, I didn't build those relationships, both, you know, with people outside of like my core group of creative friends, which was only two or three. And definitely I didn't have any, you know, professors that were kind of like keeping me under their wise tutelage and looking out for me. You know, when voting time came, or advocating for, you know, what film got what came. And I took that lesson to heart, and it was a valuable lesson, because from there, I never forgot that. And I think that that's how I was able, taking that lesson and then pivoting to adding awareness and relationship and community building to the slice of the pie that makes me a filmmaker, you know, is what enabled me to raise $500,000 for my first feature. It's what helped me, you know, see the value in 300 plus meetings to get to where I am now as a TV director, because I knew like, well, this has a value that I can't discount. And there are a lot of folks who I know are like, well, meetings are bullshit and this and that, and I've done XYZ, or, you know, fill in the blank with whatever claim they have. And I'm like, yeah, but they don't know you.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You know what I'm saying? And like, it's always an awareness campaign. And I think people just have to be honest with themselves. And, you know, another way of, there are so many examples of this, even in like, you know, raising money on a crowdfunding campaign. Like, it's not about raising money, it's about building awareness. The more people you know, the more people know about your project, the better. The more people you ask for money, the less you're going to get. Like, because then you're a cold call, and we all hang up on those. You know what I'm saying? So that was a crucial kind of milestone for me to recognize that. And also take the time to pivot and learn and apply what I'd learned, so the journey could be, you know, could continue to move forward.
Completely. I really understand what you mean about the meetings and so many other aspects about what you just said. But one thing that comes to mind from your book that I really remember too is the community. A community of artists is waiting for you. If you don't have a certain community and you're struggling to find that community, which you have found, what type of advice would you give filmmakers in that situation?
Man, that's a great point and question. I think that, you know, the shiny new thing is a syndrome, right? Like, everybody kind of wants the shiny new thing. And I think in a book I might mention that oftentimes, like, when you go to like a panel or a workshop, you see there's the people on the panel looking back at the audience, and the audience is full of people who probably want to be doing what the folks on the panel are doing. And then, you know, and then you have the audience looking back. So those are the two parties. And what happens overwhelmingly is the panel's over, the people in the audience rush the stage because they're gonna somehow in this moment build a relationship and find a collaborator, right? Like, they're going to give them their business card, or they're going to say something really witty, and the person who at that point is ready to go is going to stop and be like, let's go make some art. And, you know, while I wish it, you know, weren't that way, and while sometimes it plays out different, you know, I think the shiny new object syndrome makes you kind of look at things the wrong way. Because what's happening in real life is the people on the panel are out there trying to do projects and connect and build further relationships with the other people on the panel. And that same approach can be applied by the folks who were watching the panel. So I remember, you know, going, I'm speaking about myself, being that panel watcher. Well, this person sitting next to me to my left or three rows up, like, they are a DP who's looking to do something. They're not going to work with that person on the panel, but they might work with me. And how can I build a community of like-minded people who are in the same position? And that's recognizing where folks are in the journey and providing valuable opportunities in a symbiotic way. You know, this same thing kind of travels up the ladder to casting. Like, you're never going to it's unlikely that you're going to cast somebody who's not going to do a movie like you're doing. So you have to be honest about like who you offer roles to or who you, you know, audition or whatever. And it's the same thing. Like, so I built a team of a community of filmmakers that were always, you know, to keep the metaphor going, we were panel attendees. And then one day you look up and now you're like on the panel and now you've got your own circle. And it's because it happens organically, you know. The actor that I worked the most with ever, we started working together in 96 on my junior year short film. Then he was in my thesis film, and then he was the star of my feature film. And then, you know, fast forward to 2015, again, he's the star of this short film, Black Card. And his wife was a co-star. He suggested that we bring her in. Why? Because she was very talented, but also because it was something that she would do. You know what I mean? Like, come shoot this thing over the weekend. And then cut to 5 years later, she's number one on the show All Rise, and she's able to bring me in and get me hired to direct. And so I can never say like do this and this happens, but like what I could say is you keep making as much work as you can with people who have a shared interest and a spirit of generosity that mirrors yours. And then you look up one day and you're like, oh shit, we like just got an award. And it all changes.
Nice one. It sounds like community and having a serious group around you is something that's important. So what was it like for you to go back to your local community to make a film project there?
So returning home after graduating NYU, that was when I was really looking to apply the lesson of the film festival fiasco, right? So I was like, okay, well, I can go home, and what I have the opportunity to do is be a big fish in a small pond. You know, this was a community of, I don't know, I hope I'm not drastically off, but maybe 40 to 50,000 people, near New York City. Many of the people commute to New York, you know, it's a suburb of the city. And I was like, let me just, I know I'm going to need to raise money for this film. I don't know how it's going to happen. I don't know what the number is yet, because that evolved over time. But I do know, and I do believe that if I can make as many people as possible aware of me as, you know, the indie filmmaker with a vision and a voice and a path that only needs financial support to close the deal, then there's, on a long enough timeline, I'm gonna reach my goal or some version of it. And so I embraced going back home because I was excited to try and put these skills and find some strategies that would hopefully bear fruit. And it was constantly, you know, trying things, learning, pivoting, and responding to what information I got, what feedback I got. And much of what I did in that process of raising $500,000 for my feature, you know, it's kind of rinse repeat every time that I go to step into a new space. And the book is called Transitions, partly because of that. Because I think it's the most valuable cinematic tool in storytelling, like how you move from scene to scene and how you help to kind of illustrate a character's progression through whatever emotional journey they're going through. But also, quite literally for me, it was the transition from short film to feature filmmaker, the transition from feature filmmaker to teacher at NYU, the transition from teacher at NYU to running a production company. And like many of the principles that I learned in the early part of the School of Hard Knocks, are principles that are applicable to almost anything that you want to aspire toward.
And as a director that believes in these transitions, and obviously you've done really well from your ideas and your work rate and everything else, what part of the operation as a whole do you like the most as a director? Mm. Will it be production design? Is it obviously you write and direct. Mm. Is it a sound and audio mix? Is it, I mean, what department exactly do you love being with and working with and understand the most, would you say?
That's a great question. I feel like I'm running through so many different responses to your question because I love the journey. And I think that if you don't love the journey and the process, this is a hard business to maintain your sanity because you can't hate prep, but love production. You know what I mean? And you can't love production, but hate post because they're all part of it. Like, and that doesn't mean like if you're a chef, you have to like your favorite part of cooking meals is cleaning dishes. No, but like, you know that it's part of it and you just have to embrace it as part of it. I will say though, if you make me answer this question, I am probably most excited about that collaboration between director and actor. But the reason why I was kind of bouncing around this being my single answer is that in TV, it's a lot different than from film. There's a little less exploration in TV because you're arriving there with characters that are typically, you know, well, definitively, if it's multiple seasons in, multiple episodes in, they're more fully fleshed out. And so you're really trying to like mine out unique moments of subtext or nuance that perhaps you lean into a little bit more than usual, but they were kind of already there because the character's been designed. But like when you're working on a film, you're trying to find it. Every day you're exploring it. And I really love that process. What I think though, and what I hope is happening as I do more premium quote unquote dramas and dramedies and comedies on like, you know, the HBOs and the Showtimes and the Hulus and Amazons and whatnot, Netflixes, is that those types of TV shows on those platforms tend to be a little more interested in exploring things in a different way. And so you get an opportunity to kind of use more of that toolkit that I'm kind of referencing as more frequently used in film.
I see. Okay. So ultimately, well, not ultimately, it's basically a different question, sorry. Do you prefer writing or directing? And if you had the choice between writing for TV or writing for film, which direction do you think you would go in?
I prefer directing. Writing is hell. Writing is, I enjoy the process, but it's such a, you know, the distinction that I have is I have friends who are, you know, writers, and I give them that voice change because they'll be writing 3, 4, 5, 6 things at one time. I'm like, I want to do this next, you know, this is my next idea. I'm going to sit down with, you know, whether it's my co-writer, Candace McFarlane, or it's just me working on it. I'm going to sit down and just barrel through this shit until I figure it out. And it's just one at a time. As far as where, like which medium, I would say I would be inclined to lean toward television because I enjoy the opportunity to explore the character, the themes, the arc with more time means more nuance, less, you know, jamming plot into a very small amount of time. You know, and then even the next level of that question is, I think I do prefer what might often happen in the shorter episodic series where, you know, 13 and under, where because the number of episodes is kind of so, not so small, but it's smaller compared to like 20, 24. There are fewer, stories that you kind of have to add to fill time. You know what I mean? It's like in music, like you make the difference between a 10 song album and a 20 song album is probably a few songs that are filler. You know what I mean? That are true to the world and the character and can be like really great episodes back to the TV of it all. But, you know, the kind of finite, smaller episode count kind of demands a more finite and specific clarity to the arc that you're trying to explore in a given season.
Is there or has there been a time with any particular actors that you've really enjoyed directing where you got to explore some of the themes you just spoke about?
Yeah, I think, you know, the one thing about every episode, about episodic directing is that you're working to kind of find yourself in the script, right? Because you're showing up, you're given a script, and, you know, whether or not it's your like taste or maybe whether or not it's like your favorite character in the episode, in the show, like your job is to find what parts of this are you most connected to, and then use your unique perspective to tell this story the way the show needs to be told. You know, you gotta fulfill the promise between the audience and the show, while having there be a reason that you're there versus somebody else, or if not a reason, having there be some kind of difference in the deliverable of the episode, you know, when Pete directs versus Damian directs, right? Like, still should be the same show and good and everything's there, but there's like just there's an organic thing that I hope comes across because you have found something unique about the story that you connect with thematically that you've worked to really deliver to the audience. And so, you know, I have been able to do that on every episode that I've ever done. And it's in those moments where I'm able to have that kind of dynamic where you're, to have what you're talking about, what you're asking about, like those really, you know, maybe you're doing a couple extra takes to make sure this thing lands right. Or maybe there's a moment between you and the actor where, because maybe this thing is so important to you, and you found a way to tie it into their character and the story, maybe it renews their enthusiasm about playing something in that direction because maybe they might not have leaned into that portion of that emotion. So it's a fun thing, man. You never know what you're going to get.
With all you learned at NYU as a student of the Brilliant Place, you do mention that it doesn't necessarily mean that you're prepared to go to work because you've got this education. And from what you've said, right, about directing television, considering you're going into a world that's already created most of the time, do you think when you left NYU, it would have been a lot harder for you to have gone into television as a director or directing your own feature films?
Yeah, I think it would have been harder to get into television for sure. Because it's just not, at the time, it just was not a thing that we were taught to navigate psychologically and procedurally. You know, like there's, wow, so many, you know, and I mean, I think the whole, there's so many parts of the industry like that I think don't get the procedural breakdown that I think they could have. So for instance, right, like this woman, Stephanie Palmer, wrote a book called Good in a Room, because why do we have to think, why isn't there a way to have a good meeting? You know what I mean? Like should it all be left to chance? Or, you know, like, or you hope that you hop in a room with somebody who's in your fraternity and now it's a good meeting? Like, is there some kind of agency that we can have in that part of the process, you know? And I think because TV is so much more collaborative than film, in the sense of, in film, it kind of is the director's medium. In TV. It is the creator, writer, showrunners medium, and we're all there in support of that vision while bringing our unique talents to the table. Knowing and understanding the nuance of that is just a very, it's not for the
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Emotionally low IQ. You know what I'm saying? And I think that, you know, I just don't know. You know, we were talking about Dan Tyus's book, Directing Great Television, and he makes a great point in the book, which I'm reading now, which is, this is one job where there is no like middle ground. You've either never done it or you're doing it right now. And you've either, you know, never driven the car or a car at all, or they're like, here, do two laps on this raceway. You know, and it matters. We hope you win. And I think that there's just no way to prepare somebody for that totally, right? But I do think there are things that, and I hope my book does this, that can prepare you for what to expect. Because knowing what to expect doesn't mean you're gonna do well when it happens. You know what I mean? But you're going to be like, oh, shit, that thing is happening now. I'm getting a weird vibe, you know, for whatever reason. And I remember the book said to think about why this might be happening. And now I got a better idea and I can control my emotions and maybe get another episode here instead of, you know, arching my back and barking and then finding myself out of a job and with a bad reputation.
So in the book, you do mention emotions and maybe controlling them and where they may take you and may they might not take you, depending on the problems that will be unforeseen on any project that you're involved in, whether it's short film, feature, television. How do you cope when things go bad? Do you have a certain coping mechanism you rely on? I loved the bit earlier in the book when you say about having a rested mind, something along the line, a rested mind is something that shouldn't go to waste. You get up early, you go to the gym, you get prepared for every day. But even with that being said, when things do go wrong, how do you cope with it? Is there a certain coping mechanism you rely on or practice of ideas you go to?
I think that for me, it's been educating myself as to all the things that could go wrong. And obviously there are still surprises that will happen as to like the specific, like, oh, well, it never went wrong like that before. You know what I mean? But like, just knowing that there are so many weak points, and by weak points, I mean points where something could go wrong, where the levee could break, where the dam could, you know, burst a hole, you know. Every day as you move through the production of a piece of content, that because I know it's inevitable and because I know it's likely, I'm more or less just kind of waiting. I don't want to say waiting for it to happen, because that's not a good place to be. But when it does happen, it's like, okay, this is the kind of thing that can happen. And now what are the ways that we can get out of the situation? The best part, though, about that, in my opinion, is that once you start knowing what can happen, you do your best to avoid those things going into, you know, production. So how you talk about something, like when you you know, like I've learned, like there are certain things, like when a thing is really important to me and I know that a scene can begin to unravel for a lot of reasons, right? And by unravel, I mean unravel from like the super specific thing that I thought about before anybody else started talking, right? Like, yeah. If that happens, I've learned like, okay, at the end of the day, for instance, this scene is about this for me. And this moment right here in this particular style or something kind of adjacent to it is what is most important to me in the scene. And so if, you know, and let's say an actor disagrees with blocking or, you know, the prop's not right, maybe I can maintain what I'm talking about with a particular camera move or a lens choice or whatever, and I can still communicate, you know, what I was trying to say with the scene in the same fashion. Because there are just so many, my thought is that there are so many questions that happen every day of production, and prep and post. And so you're never going to bat 1,000, but I feel like if 85% of the time, you know, your answers are leaning in the right direction, you're making a pretty good piece of content, you know. But when you stop having, when you have a lower percentage of the right quote unquote answer, and by right I mean is congruent with what the show is trying to do, with what the themes are, with what needs to happen in the episode, that's when things start falling apart and people are like, what the fuck am I watching? You know what I mean? Like, because I feel like the 15% that I might lose, no one knows what I wanted it to be, right? But they will have gotten what that scene needed to be because I protected it for the audience. And so, yeah, I feel like I've been talking so long, I forgot the question, but but I feel like that's the goal.
Have you thought of upgrading your cinematography game? Would you like to have an ASC cinematographer mentor you for free? Join veteran cinematographer Suki Medenzovic, ASC, Disney, Pixar, FX Networks, Netflix, American Horror Story. As he teaches you how to create beautiful images using 3 lighting techniques he has mastered on film sets over his 30 plus years in the film industry. Each technique uses basic, low-cost lighting equipment so that anyone can achieve beautiful visuals no matter your project's budget. If you want to take your cinematography to the next level, visit filmmakingconversations.com to sign up for instant access.
I did a documentary on Black tankers in World War II. And something I learned in the process of making that documentary was this term called commander's intent. And commander's intent is the idea or the reality of like, I can't tell you, you know, run 30 feet, shoot 8 bullets, roll, duck behind a tree, then throw a grenade. Like, we don't know how this is going to play out, right? But commander's intent is take that hill 300 yards away by sundown, you know? And so that's kind of, I was like, that's such a true thing. Like I'm trying to shoot this scene, accomplish what the script calls for, whether it's, and if it's a film, then I'm making some of those decisions, many more of them. If it's TV, I'm trying to accomplish what the script calls for and make sure I'm certain of what the showrunner needs. And then after that, however I get there, I get there, right? But hopefully I maintain a good vibe on set. I collaborate well with others, and I inspire folks to want to give their best.
Brilliant. That's really good. It sounds like you could also be a mentor, because I know you've learned from and appreciated a mentor you've had when you was at ABC television program Disney. Tell us about your experience there and what that eventually led to.
Well, I mean, so, you know, and here in the States, I don't know how it works there, but there's there was a point in 2014 where the DGA here, the Directors Guild of America, did an analysis on the prior year's hiring of directors. And I will be ballpark in the numbers, but I believe it was like out of 800 or 900 episodes of television, from broadcast to streaming to pay cable to basic cable, out of 800 to 900 episodes, only 7% of the directors of those episodes were not white males. And so no matter what my number is, if I'm off, that's a very small percentage, right? And so the Guild worked to task the studios and networks or whatever to do something about that and help create a pipeline of visibility and awareness so they could be familiar with folks like me and some of my friends who went through these programs and are now very successful. And they can't claim they don't know who these folks are. They're not seeing their work. And so I did four of those programs. I did one at HBO. I did one at Disney ABC, which you're referring to. I did Sony and I did NBC Universal. And along the way, I met a lot of folks that were like crucial in my progression and development, and were mentors and continue to be friends at this point as well. And it's funny, right? Because, you know, going back to the panel anecdote, it's like this was the exact opposite, in the sense of, okay, I was selected for a program and I was given someone from the panel to mentor me specifically, right? So it's not like, you know, so it, as unreal as that, even, I mean, that's like, that's still just a grouping. It's like an arranged marriage, you know? But the nature of the relationship was to try and build one. And so I took everything I learned on the journey about trying to build community and build relationships and applied it to that in a real way. And I want to say, like, not in a exploitative, like, you know, oh, he's just trying to network with people, but like being, having genuine interest for people, being genuinely interested in helping folks achieve whatever goals they're working on, even if my side of the exchange is at a deficit, to the point of like if you're higher up the totem pole than me, maybe all I can do is like tweet support and tell people to check something out, or like make sure I come to screenings, you know, and maybe you can get me a job. But like, you know, even still, that there's a reciprocity there that begins to build a real relationship. And yeah, over time, you know, many of those folks helped advocate for me to get jobs, because the first one that you get, there's really no reason, like, in all honesty, man, like there's no reason for anybody to hire you the first time for something you've never fucking done. Why? Like, yeah. Like, why would you like, would you be like, yo, I've never replaced a roof, but I'm your guy. I'd be like, I'm going to go with, you know, like, so yeah. It's the same thing. And it's always going to be those relationships that, that help you kind of get over the edge. You know, I know directors who have maybe fallen out of work for a variety of reasons, and they're kind of more, well, they're older than I am, you know, and they a lot of times they get brought back in the game because of relationships. It's unavoidable.
So your relationships, one of those relationships led you to shadow a director. I'm guessing that may have been part of one of the mentoring projects you were involved in. What is shadowing like for you, being able to observe everything in that way?
Well, in a way, man, it's like I was kind of tailor-made to shadow because I've been watching shit all my life. I've always been a watcher. And so, and I'm kind of introverted by nature, but the nature of the job requires me to develop some extroverted traits. But I could sit back and not talk to anybody and be fine, in all honesty. And so what happens in, you know, they call it shadowing. Some folks, and I like to call it observing directors, because the terminology comes from this idea of like, you're there to see, but not be seen. you know, so you're like at the heels of the director, kind of watching them do their thing, but you know, you ain't asking no questions, and unless you find moments that work. But it's really just about, it's almost like the idea of like you're being given the opportunity to have a video feed into the process, you know. Yeah. And so I took that, every one of those opportunities, as an opportunity to try and see what it's like to go from not having the job to having the job. So, because I knew that there's no in between, like we were discussing, then my thought was, if I go in and treat it like I've been hired, I'm gonna not be responsible for these things, but I can kind of play this little simulation game where that's the case. So I'm in prep meetings, I'm taking all the notes, I'm breaking down the script, I'm shot listing entire episodes. You know, I'm in the meetings and on, you know, the phone calls and whatever it might be, sometimes just literally tagging along. The director gets up and goes to get some food in the cafeteria. Like, I'm going, you know what I mean? Like, finding how much they want me around and to what degree, what kind of can I ask questions? Yeah. Like, at the end of the day, or should I wait, you know, or anytime it looks like you're not bothered? Like, I'm trying to find the dance here, but, you know, really absorb the information. And so I did that for 8 to 10 episodes, with no guarantee ever of being hired, but I'm a bit of a broken record here. To me, the whole byproduct was there were two guarantees for me in this. It was, I'd build up my awareness campaign because I'd go and do this and hopefully people would be like, oh, he's not bad. You know, he was cool. Oh, he wants to do episodes, whatever. I just need them knowing I'm out here trying to be a director and I'm not crazy. But like, B, I'm learning how production actually works because I'd never been on TV sets before. And maybe what I learn here, I can take back and amplify and enhance my own projects, you know? And so rinse, repeat. And I was very intent on shadowing on as many shows as I could because I wanted to build those relationships. And, you know, it all worked out well for me because I booked, you know, I shadowed on Blackish, Grey's Anatomy, Greenleaf, Silicon Valley. Those are all shows that I ended up directing, multiple episodes of many of them. So, you know, it's just, for me, it was finding, well, where are the opportunities for me? You know, these diversity programs, I went through 4 of them.
Wow.
It's the unfortunate terrain, you know, because all of the things that we're talking about, like I made 2 features, you know, I won Tribeca with a script. I was making shorts. I was winning awards. You know what I mean? But I couldn't crack the force field and get into television until this came around and gave me that, you know, that window in there.
I'm so happy for you that it did, because they sound like amazing opportunities from what you've said and what I've read and what I've heard from other people on the podcast, like Bethany Rooney, and she said something similar, yeah, but from the perspective of a woman and being mm-hmm. in the industry and trying to help other people that we don't necessarily see behind the camera and in charge directing. But one point in the book, yeah, you said something that I can relate to, and I think a lot of the listeners can. And I'll quote, "I was unsatisfied and growing bitter with every shoot."
Hmm.
What makes you unsatisfied and grow bitter as a director?
Well, I think we have these things that we want to be doing, you know, and we have the reality of whatever industry that we're in, you know, and there are, you know, just being real, like you can keep your positive attitude and your creative engine going, you know, but there might also be times where you're like, yo, I've seen, you know, person blank do X, Y, Z. And it's like, yo, what the fuck? Or, you know what I mean? Like, or, you know, all the programs that I did, I applied to like 2 to 3 times, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, I see.
And it wasn't until I made, the short black card that I got in. And that was a $30,000 investment from me. You know, once my company was at a place where I could like afford to do that, I didn't want to spend that much, but I did, because I was like, well, fuck it. Like, I got to be about it, you know? And despite 2 features and Sundance and Tribeca Awards and all these various things, it's like, I'm going to make a short film again. You know what I mean? Like, but prior to that, it was just like, because that was really the pivot for me, like making that short film and not putting any expectation on it. Because rewinding back to the beginning of our convo, it was the expectation of Sundance equals success and a professional career that made me bitter about not getting any accolades at the NYU Festival, right? And then that's 2001. Then you go 2005, feature film. I've raised $500,000 for this thing. You know, it gets a limited theatrical run. It's in Walmart, Netflix. It comes on Showtime. You know, by 2008, that's been the journey of that thing, which was a 9-year journey. I make the documentary about Black Tankers in like a 2-year period with Andre Brower narrating. These are things that are happening, and I'm just kind of like, the old perspective that I had before pivoting was like, I'm doing all the things. Can't look me in my eyes and tell me I'm not doing all the things, right? And so I was like, all right, well, what am I doing wrong? And this is in the introduction of the book, right? Like, what if everything I'm doing is wrong? Like, how can I pivot? And I was like, well, you know what? I got to let go of the bitterness. I got to just go out here and do these things without expectation. And then there will be nothing to be bitter about if it's about the work, right? Like, I can rinse, repeat, create over and over again. And if it's about getting better as a director, as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, I'll have nothing to be bitter about, because I can't control whether or not meeting these perceived milestones will turn key, you know, toward some kind of upper level of success, because it's different for everybody. And it's definitely different for a Black filmmaker.
That's incredible. It's obvious you've got a fantastic drive, and this is I can't remember exactly the way you put it in the book, but I think you said, "This is me" in capital letters when you realize what it meant to be a part of film in a class, or when you were a lot younger, after being interested in music and rap and soccer. Where do you get this drive from? Because in the book, you also mention your mum and sister and your family never question your goals. Do you think the fact that they didn't, and they were a helping hand and a hug and a kiss when needed, is part of what made you what you are today? And if you didn't have your mom, sister, and family around you from the start, how do you think things would have worked out for you?
It's a great question, man. I have this feeling that, you know, it's just, I don't know if it can ever be proven, you know, maybe Malcolm Gladwell has some anecdote about it, but like, I feel like nature and nurture are kind of a bit of a handshake, but I do feel like nature wins, right? And I joke that, like, if I'd have grown up in a different environment, like, I'd have been a really good, whatever, farmer. I'd have been the best drug dealer. I'd have been like, because like, I just always was like, I want to do this. How do I do it? How do I do it better than that? How do I do my best at it? How do I make my best, you know, more better than their best and recognizable? Okay, well, if that's not the best, what if I do it more often? You know what I'm saying? Like, I was always about like how to figure something out. And this is just like, I just thought about this in answering the question, but I remember the first time I went to like a gun range with a friend, and he was joking with people when we got back. He was like, this is the first time anybody's ever asked me, how do you load the bullets quicker? How do you find, you know what I mean? Not that I'm out here like, you know, NRA, yeah, but like, yeah. I'm like, how and why? And so, you know, I just feel like I was fortunate to not have the roadblocks of whatever psychological challenges you get when you don't have the support of those nearest to you. Very fortunate for that. And I know that, and I appreciate that. But I do think that, you know, that shit ain't get me through me losing investors. You know what I mean? Like that didn't get me through, like, you know, having a fire, you know, on the first day of a film shoot, being kicked out of a location. Mm. So I think, like, at a certain point, even with all of that support, even with everything that kind of lifts you up and keeps you there, like, you know, at a certain point, you gotta turn the switch, and that switch is only powered by you.
Yes, that's completely true. And that bit in the book about the fire, and when you also say about only my current, I think it was Kerry Washington or a different actress, sorry, uh-huh. one that I've, her name I forgot, but she's famous now, that's for sure. Only had a certain amount of time allocated to be on set that day. And you were saying words maybe you wouldn't normally say loud and often.
Well, you know what's interesting? So she had a hard out. It was a final day of shooting. It was a big scene, too much to shoot, overwritten, not skilled enough to know how to do it efficiently, you know? And now here's more full circle, Damien. I'm co-executive producer and producing director on a new show called Reasonable Doubt that is produced by her company, and she directed the pilot. And so it'll be out on Hulu toward the end of this year. But we were chatting about this in Video Village about a month ago while the pilot was shooting, and she doesn't even remember this moment. You know what I mean? Like it's also so weird how, like, you know, we end up having our own narratives for things, right? Because I know that there are people who for sure had to know what was going on, and maybe she was in a character space or who knows what was going on. But it's just funny, like, when you think about that, and this was an unasked question, but I've learned to not put value on a lot of exchanges with people sometime, right? Because, like, when you do all of these meetings, for instance, like, you could have what you think was a great meeting and then not get the job. So then what was I experiencing, right? And then on the flip, you could have what was a really awkward or quote unquote bad meeting, and then they hire you for two episodes. So either I can't read people, or or I just need to not put expectation on anything. You know what I'm saying? Like, I need to just go out there and be myself and do what I prepared to do, rinse, repeat, and see what happens when I'm presenting honestly with my best foot forward. And I don't know, man, I feel like that after all these years, it's like, that's the fucking key. But it's so simple that nobody will believe you when you tell them that shit, because they'll be like, you know, until they recognize, like, life really is simple.
So you think sometimes people have difficulties when you try and explain to them about a certain amount of awareness that they might not need to have in that way?
Yeah, just be yourself, and don't sometimes you can respond to things that aren't there. I guess that's my point, right? Like if you put a value system on every exchange you have, you know, you will be wrong probably 100% of the time. You know what I mean?
Wow.
So just do you, you know. I can think of shows where, like, I thought it was going, you know, horribly, and then they're like, hey, we want to give you a bunch of episodes for this next show. And I'm like, oh shit, okay. You know what I mean?
Like, one thing again that I liked, you said about having a voice as a you know, as a filmmaker. And funnily enough, sometimes people don't, in my opinion, which is, I find very interesting, but that's another topic or subject, whatever. And you said about the five films that people like the most, if you write them down and you'll be, you have an idea of what your voice is. What are your five favorite films?
So with the acknowledgement that this could shift in 10 minutes, I will say, and I'll tell you the reasons why for each one. Do the Right Thing. And I mentioned that in the book. It was the first time that I saw something that spoke to the world that I knew. Casablanca. I think it's one of the more perfect films, in the sense of, if you get down to like the nuts and bolts of it, it's a war film made during the war within which it's exploring. It's a comedy in many ways. There are so many one-liners in that film that people say today that they may not even know come from that film. It is a love story. It's a drama. I'd even argue that it's part musical, when the two opposing sides, you know, sing their national anthems back against each other in Rick's Cafe. And it's just smart and super well done, at a time when these directors were kind of on a pipeline, hopping from film to film to film to film. So you got Do the Right Thing, Casablanca. I like Seven by Fincher. I think that was eye-opening for me, and the fact that it was, you know, at the end of the day, there are only so many stories and genres that we have, and it was one of the first films that I remember that really mixed genre in a new way, because it was a buddy film, buddy cop film, right? Which is also a love story, right? It was a psychological thriller. It was horrific in many ways, and it was just, it was awesome. I would say, it's funny, Spike Kids 2, Malcolm X, just because, I mean, that performance from Denzel is amazing. And that's a long film that if it came on today, when I go out into my living room, I'm watching. and then finally, I would say The Limey by Soderbergh. And it's really just a virtuoso class in minimalism and film editing.
What is it about the editing that you really enjoy in that film?
You know, he's taking footage. So Terrence Stamp is coming from, is coming to the States to find his daughter, who's been, you know, caught up in something with this Peter Fonda character. And he's intercutting, I don't remember the name of the movie, but Soderbergh is intercutting footage from a movie that Stamp did in maybe the 60s or 70s, because it kind of is in line with the storyline. So that's happening. And then just the way that he moves, he condenses time and plays with transitions is really awesome. I mean, I was just talking to somebody about No Sudden Move yesterday, and there's a moment in that film where, I guess it's Brendan Fraser is driving this car, and Don Cheadle and Benicio Del Toro are arguing about who will get in the back, who's going to get in the car first, and I'm not riding in the back with you or whatever, right? And it's a nice, witty kind of exchange for, I don't know, a minute or so. And then the door closes, and we get the sound of the door closing, and it's a match cut to the door opening at wherever they went to next. And it's like, the scene was about these two guys who fucking don't like each other. Doesn't matter how they got there, what the drive was like, you know, it's just about when we open the door at the next location, we see who gets out and who sat where. And you're like, that was great. Cause there's no need to show me anymore. That doesn't have, it wouldn't have had character value, you know? So yeah, I appreciate people were kind of trying to find ways to explore these tools and techniques through, you know, that are minimal. All we got is the camera, the editing, you know, light, music, you know, pace, you know what I mean? Like, and it's just like, well, what do you do with that? And how do you really make each of those different tools sing uniquely in concert with the greater episode or film or whatever? And that to me is that's the constant. You'll never get that shit right or perfect. And that's why you just keep doing it, because you're in search of it.
I see what you mean. I'm going to have to go back and watch The Limey. I haven't seen it in a long, long time. Some nice choices. The Spike ones for me stand out, especially Do the Right Thing. When I first saw that, it just blew my mind.
Yeah.
As a kid in Southeast London, and came on a channel we have called Channel 4. And I was just like, what is this?
Yeah.
And the song, my God. You know, the intro, the dance. Yeah. Rosie Perez, I think the lady's called. And I've never seen an intro like that before. I was just so intrigued. Watching that film.
Well, here's a cool thing too. I just had the chance to work with her on The Flight Attendant.
Wow.
So it was like, nice. You know, again, all these things, man, it just kind of like, you know, it comes full circle, man. I love it.
That is complete full circle. That must have been more than amazing for you to like turn up and feel, you know, one of your favorite films, and she's an integral part of the film, certainly.
Yeah.
What will we be seeing from you next?
So at this point, let me think. So the Flight Attendant episode, that'll come out sometime in 2022. This show, Reasonable Doubt, that I mentioned with Kerry Washington, it'll be 10 episodes on Hulu sometime in the fall, I believe. I'm doing two of the episodes, so the second episode and then the finale, episode 10. You know, because I'm an EP on that, I'll be there every day. So I won't be doing anything other than that show until June. But in the meantime, I have a pilot at Showtime in development that hopefully will get greenlit. I think the script will be going in pretty soon by the writer, Matt Pikin. And it's about the NBA player, Matt Barnes. It's called Education of Matt Barnes. And we're excited about it. I think it's a different kind of take on a comedy. And I got a few things that I'm finishing up, a heist script, and I got a show that I'm gonna be tweaking and pitching, and you know, be out here creating, man. If I can come up with a short film idea that's, you know, easily realized and I can shoot it on a weekend, I will do that too, because it's just about being in search of, you know, the perfect game. Like, isn't that why you bowl? You know what I mean? Don't you bowl to get 300 one of these days? You know what I mean? Or, you know, you pitch to strike out 27 motherfuckers, you know, like, or what is it? Nine times 327. So, you know, like, I think it's that, man. And like, what I've come to appreciate and know for sure is that every time, you know, there are things that I do in my personal projects that I know for sure give me a tool that I will then put into play on something that someone's hired me to do or something down the line. You know, why would you let these creative muscles atrophy, especially when you got a camera here on your phone, or you know somebody that has some equipment, or I know a bunch of actors. Like, to me, it's like having gym equipment and not using it.
I like that. I'm going to quote you on that one. I like that. Pete, thanks so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. So much of what you said regarding the book, and not necessarily regarding the book as well, is going to be amazingly helpful for many, many people listening to this podcast, and many new listeners that will come along and want to hear some of the older episodes too. In the show notes, everyone, I'm going to put details of Pete's social media contacts and where to buy his book online, and definitely do it. I've learned a lot reading from it, so I'm sure many of you will learn a lot too. So Pete, thanks so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Damien, and this has been an awesome interview, man. Like, I appreciate the care and research that you do to even come in so prepared and look for the finer insights from, you know, what we have to offer as guests. So I appreciate what you're doing, man, and thank you.
Now, in the show notes, I've got bags of information about Pete Chapman and where you can find him and where you can find the book and watch his brilliant work. I'm about to watch his most recent short film, Black Card.
I'll put a link to the film in the show notes also, and I hope to hear from you all very soon.